Yeah, thanks for the introduction, and also thanks for having me talking here today. It's quite a pleasure and an honor, and I've been coming to this event for many years already, and also I've been doing stuff here over the years, so you might recognize this or the other project. Yeah, thanks for Art and Beauty having me. I think it's great. Yeah, just for reference, I think this is one of the, well, I came to Berlin in the mid-90s, and I studied architecture at the UdK, the University of Arts in Berlin. And yeah, I think 97 or 98, the Congress moved to Berlin from here. And important part of my, or influence in my artistical career, sort of. Yeah, we were in art school, we were still trained to draw ink, plans, and architecture while there was web and internet coming up, super interesting. I went over to the technical campus to write emails to one friend I knew of, had an email address in Hamburg, and it was way more interesting to design a house and then to play, some game, load it into some game and play in there instead of drawing by ink. So I was always like torn in between, learning this like very old craft, and at the same time there was something super interesting happening. And then there's always these moments, and you all know this we did tons of projects, like a lot of 3D, a lot of video stuff, etc. And we were quite free to do what we wanted to do. And then I had this moment where I lost burned CD-ROMs, and you lose data because your laptop gets stolen or like the backup's not working. And suddenly, like, oh wow, like where's all these projects? Like where's the beauty I made and the 3D stuff? And I developed that need to make these things tangible, touchable again. And this is like one, yeah, big part of my artist practice, or like my main mission, like to discuss this online-offline relationship. And I'm going to show like some very classic projects you might have seen online at some point. And then I also will go more into CCC-related and more to the fun stuff later on. So just, the typical projects. It's called Map. It's about Google Maps, and it's about this Google Map marker here in the middle. And I started this in 2006. It's an interface object. It's sitting on the screen. When you zoom in, it kind of stays at the same pixel size, but it casts a shadow at the same time. Like, the more you zoom in, the more it becomes part of the city. So I started to make these in 2006, where it was really still, like, kind of this blurring boundary discussion, like, kind of started, or for me was quite, yeah, very important. Today, these sculptures, and I've been showing this project a lot over the past 7-8 years, here in Taiwan, Taipei, or France 2 years ago. It's very much about this irritating moment, like, oh yeah, I know this icon very well, but wait a second, what is it doing here? And we're very used to, use all these tools and be online. At the same time, we are still made of flesh and walk in the city, and there's different rules going on there. So I like to kind of break in between these boundaries. And at the same time, of course, today, and it's sort of like this piece for me is like already historical in the sense that we overcame that point a long time ago already, especially here with you guys. This is like the recent setup in Kassel, where I had a show in September, October. And Google is not building these markers, right? But they're super important, and they're occupying that location, this whole location story with search, etc. So I think it's just a question of time till they will enter like billboard marketing with face recognition. I read somewhere in England this is already coming, like the camera on top, like having targeted you. So it's really the step into the physical is coming in a different way, but it kind of represents how important it is here. And all these markers in these cases, it's always the city center. So when you Google for Hamburg, I don't know what pops up here, but I always have the goal to put it exactly at the place where Google claims the city center to be. And wow, yeah, is this a city center? So it's really also some programmer put it there because the name is there, but sometimes it's in a main square, but not always. So I played a lot of computer games. Yeah, I grew up with computer games. This is Counter-Strike, the map called Dust, and it's the last game I really played excessively 10 years ago, or more than 10 years ago. What I like very much about these games, or yeah, when you look at them and compare to movies, you need to know the map and the architecture very, very well to survive in there. So it's not like a movie where you talk about the same atmosphere or scenes or what happened, what the plot. The plot itself, I would say, in these, like, especially like these kind of first-person shooter games, there's no plot. It's just like fighting each other, right? But the architecture and the space itself unfold as a plot. And you need to, like, when you ever play one of these games, you will always recognize like the space, and you know, will know exactly what's right behind that door on your right. And just to survive in there, it's super crucial to know the map by heart. And as humans also, we are trained to remember space. I mean, I still have trouble in this building here, kind of, right, with all the stairs, and I kind of get it with the two big rooms next to each other, but yeah, so we got lost here, or in the airport, you pass every, I don't know, once a month, but here, you would never get lost, because you played it like, I mean, if you played it. And then I think the gamers very early on, they realized like that shift, or that they made this kind of connection. Oh, wow, look, we can sit on top of each other in the game. Like, what is this like to do this in real life? And it doesn't make sense for a SEALs team, but well, let's do it. And at the same point also here, you have the dust map from above and aerial view. And then I found these pictures on the web. They would just rebuild the map in the sand on the beach. Not because they had a printout, but because they know it by heart. And so I've been dealing with this map over a long time. I mean, also Dust Map and Counter-Strike is kind of, yeah, legendary. And this is a scale 1-to-1 model for the show in Kassel I recently had. So to enter the show, you needed to pass that crucial door. And yeah, if you played that game, you know it's like there's like this line of sight in the middle. I've been experimenting also in other ways. So here you see the section of this one of these gates. In August, I had a show in public in Sherbrooke in Canada, near to Montreal. And we were building 20 of these crates who are like positioned in the space of that map in an old prison yard. Prison yard from the 19th century. And it kind of fitted super well because it's like this closed space. And yeah, with the sky. So you get an idea, like here, the gate is sort of just cardboard, but it's like very precise 1-to-1. Here it's just the crates taken from the game, and also they're pixelized, right? And you get an idea from far away, but when you look closer, you really see it. So this has been going on. And I also, there's 3D prints of the prototypes of the whole map, and like one of my far goals would be, and I kind of claim, I mean, how many people have been in Hamburg? How many people have been in important places in the world? And I don't know, Times Square or Mecca and Kaaba, and how many people have been in here, right? A lot of people have been in here. And I claim it's cultural heritage. Like, it should be like, why not having this built as a museum / real life sculpture? And this is like a very far goal, and it would be very big to build 100 by 120 meter. But yeah, I would love to see this, like, and not only from cardboard, but like from a concrete, and maybe it's going to be like a pilgrim place for the gamers. And in 200 years, people will think like, what is this? Like, some funny cultural artifact. And I made some first tests like to build how to build this, and of course, this looks more like Minecraft now, right? another project from the game section, World of Warcraft. You probably all know this game very well. What I think is interesting in this screenshot is that like the party who just killed the dragon in the back, they're taking a group picture because the moment is so important, right? They spent so many hours on like kind of achieving that goal, and they know each other very well over the internet, and they But it's like, it's for outside, for people like not being in these worlds, it's really hard to understand what's going on and how close these relationships like grow online. And I love this as a reference, like when, I don't know, like when you go to travel with a group, you take a group picture, and here they take a group picture. And I got interested in these name markers, which are very common in all 3D games, and in any like other online world. And there's a workshop I've been doing quite a lot of time here. This was, I think, the last time in the Laguna Art Museum in California 2-3 years ago. So everybody builds their own real name from cardboard, and then we mount them on plastic strips, and then we walk our names in the city as if we were MMO, right? And it's like, I mean, this is 2007, I think I started this. And it's like, we're gonna have this tomorrow, right? With Google Glass. I mean, I kind of, or let's say the data is there, right? We all know now the data is there and they can put names all the time on, over our heads. They will probably kind of try not to put these names in the first place because this is always the scary moment with face recognition and people will freak out, but we know the data is there. So, and it's kind of, 7 years ago, 2007, this was fun. Now it's becoming sort of creepy a little bit. And also it's interesting to think about how, like 10 years ago, well, there was no reason to put your name online, right? Today, when you're not, cannot be found by name online, you might be a terrorist, right? I mean, and at the same time in the city, like in public space, well, I can walk up to someone and get to know someone and ask for the name, but you don't walk your name, right, in public. It's sort of, it's like this private thing. So it's a beautiful experiment also for the group, and then we walk each other our names. Also, it's like this little play going on. And we had a lot of fun on that beach here on a Saturday afternoon. And I've been doing this in different countries. Also, it's very interesting. And when you do this in Germany, in Berlin, it's like, oh yeah, that's an art project. In US, there were people like, oh, is this like advertising for a political party? And here, and this was in Seoul in South Korea, and it's like a student quarter, and people would just yell the name like through the whole street, super loud. Like, so the reaction to this is also very different from where you do it. And it's interesting also combined to the online rules, right? I mean, people strip naked online all the time, but you don't do it in public. So kind of this like this gap developed. And of course, I mean, things change now. When there's always only Facebook comments, then people behave more, et cetera. But it is like, it is very different spaces. And at the same time, this online, offline, or yeah, there's always the name pair of analog, digital. It's kind of so much woven into each other, we cannot make a separation anymore, right? But at the same time, well, it's a different still, I think, if you talk face to face or if you chat online. I mean, yeah. And now we come to the next project, and this has to do a little bit with also you'll see a second. So it's about chatting, and here again, World of Warcraft, there's many other games. To chat online, it's like a super old communication channel, has also BS very specific qualities. It's a very narrow channel, but people kind of talk more what they would say face to face, etc. So what would it be like to chat in real life? So I made these two speech bubbles. They have a backlight projection in the back, and the people kind of wearing the keyboard can type into the speech bubble and it will appear just above your head. And what is this like? And it's the same thing again with the NSA knows all the data. They could put the speech bubble to our head. But when you order a drink in a Club Transmediale party here at the bar, you would immediately get it because it's really big. It also stays there for 20 seconds, so people have people can read the message much longer. When you sit next to a table, people talking, you might hear parts of the conversation, but the written words we all know it's like way more static, and you can always go back and find out what people said. And this project was also part of the Congress in 2007, I think. And I kind of beta tested it here. We had a lot of fun. You might know this guy. And also Brie Pettis was here in this year. And Hello, hackers. Break the system. I hope you're here somewhere. This was a lot of fun. It was also used by the Fibot and today called Digital Courage for like actions in public space about RFID chips and in fashion. And yeah, it's like part of these projects kind of came from here. And also, I will talk about this in the end. And now there's another branch of more about also internet related, but no 3D, no games. Are You Human is about capture codes, and we all know like the technology of capture code, completely automated Turing test to tell humans and computers apart. It's like this annoying little JPEG at the bottom there, and it's that moment where the script and the server is asking you, are you human? Like, can you prove to me that you're human to prevent the spamming? But it's interesting that the Turing test used to be you sitting in front of the screen deciding if you talk to a human or to a computer, and now it's the software on the script deciding on you, right? And this is old ones. Like, this is from also captures from 2007. They change over the years. There's all these different sound captures and Google Street View, house number captures, but I think it's like a very crucial. It describes very well that moment we are at, how important how machines or software computers kind of. Well, it's difficult to say this here. They're not deciding on us, right? We all know it's programmed, and it's a race of like the spammers try to kind of get over this problem, and the humans also try to solve it. Sometimes you still need a few of them to kind of to get to it. I like them very much because they have these extra elements in there, and I introduced them as business cards. So maybe we come to that point in the future when you hand this over, like, oh, can you read this to me, please? Right? I mean, then I blew them up and made objects of them and put them in public space next to graffiti. And it's very close to like tags, right? It's like it's access code for a certain neighborhood. If you can't read this, you're not allowed to come. Or yeah, if you can't read this, you're not part of the group, etc. I shot this in different locations. This was in Vienna, 2009, and yeah, it takes a while to find it down here. And it's also interesting how then I also made them from aluminum, that because these capture codes, they're unique, right? I mean, everything else on the web we copy all the time, we can download. We still know how to do this, of course, but. Once you use them, they're gone, right? They will not. The statistics that this exact capture code will appear is like super minimal. So there are a lot of these sort of these more in artistic practice, like unique artifacts. So I made them in like Apple aluminum sort of. Eternal, and then also a recent one I made for the show in Kassel is a big one, like a floor piece, and it's made from rusted steel, and it's also disappearing, but very slowly over time. So I think it captures a kind of describe very well how what's our relation here, and also a kind of we all know that captures are not working anymore either, right? Because like the computing power becomes bigger and bigger. And there's some more examples like with passwords, etc. How this is like these systems are not working anymore. Google Portraits is about the genre of portraits. Like what is a portrait? Used to be paintings. Used to be photography a lot. Today I claim like the contemporary portrait is like when I don't know you, I Google you and I get 10 results of you, right? And this is what we get to know of each other in the first place. And it's very fast, it's very responsive, but also, and it may say a lot, but at the same time it says nothing. And I think. And also then you have name collusions, there's people with the same names, and there's all this funny stuff going on. And what I did, I took the search URL and put it into a, this time it's like a semi-code, but later on I put them into QR codes, and they're hand-drawn. So I make these hand-drawn QR codes, which is nothing more than just a search on Google, but it's a search for a person. So I say this is like a portrait. In this example, is Penelope Umbrico, which is an artist friend from New York City. And it's handmade, sort of the camera, the software doesn't really care because there's error correction. And the drawing is static, but the actual portrait online is like, kind of keeps changing depending on the algorithm, depending on what the artist or the portrait person is doing. And so this is a self-portrait made of thumbprints. And also, most recently, I did this one for a show in Paris. This is Edward Snowden portrait. And you can go pretty wild like when you level up the error correction. So it's like this technical process. We can't read that code ourselves. At the same time, I would say Google first 10 results is like the contemporary portrait of today, sort of. Some more, yeah, we have Dead Drops, which I did in 2010, and for this I'm going to show a quick video. Dead Drop is an offline, anonymous, peer-to-peer file-sharing network, and you can be part of it. Okay, so yeah, the idea. It's like this offline file sharing network. It's an open project. Everybody can participate. It's very simple to make your own dead drop by just embedding this USB drive into a wall. You can cement it in. You can glue it somewhere. I started this in 2010 when I was artist in resident at iBeam. It's a media arts center in New York City. I started with these. Actually, I kind of arrived in the city. I fell sick. I only had like 2 weeks left. And let's do this little project here. And I made these 5 dead drops in New York and then posted a picture set on Flickr and wrote a blog post. And it kind of exploded afterwards. It's I don't know. I'm very much in love with that picture of the data and the USB drive literally cemented into the wall. It's like super the opposite of what we have today with a cloud and everything is connected and everything is controlled. So it's really, you need to go to the place, you don't know what's on there, or the dead drop might be gone already. It might be dangerous, there might be a virus on there, right? Everybody's asking that question. So it has all these influences on it, and it's really, for me, kind of that gesture. You kneel down in the street and it's wet and it's dirty. Like instead of you have like a clean internet and you have your clean computer, etc. It's it takes it back to the very much to the city. It turns also you put it into a house and kind of for me like it turns the whole building into a flash drive. All these effects and of course it's anonymous and there's no IP address and well it's. It's funny how this kind of, I did this in 2010 and, well, it was popular then for a year maybe, and now it got popular again after the summer of Snowden, kind of, people making dead drops again and journalists calling me if there was like suspicious material on there really. So it kind of became like a whole a different view angle on this. So these are the first 5 dead drops in New York City. This is the website. deaddrops.com, you can go to there. Yesterday, there were 1,304 dead drops being made over the past three years. This is a world map of all the dead drops being made. We zoom in onto Hamburg, and there are quite a lot in Hamburg. You need to know, like they don't stay long there. It depends on how you put them, how like kind of visible they are. And of course, it's public space. You can also see there's a wireless one up here, which is a pirate box. And there's all these single pages for each dead drop. So you have always 3 pictures from the location and the map and a description to it. So these are pictures from a workshop I recently did in Barcelona. These are some early pictures. And it's interesting. Yeah, there's more coming. I also like this one. Yeah. So, and the fun part about this sort of open project, and for me, it's like an art. You could even call this an art performance, right? Because everybody taking part in it. A lot of these people doing this don't care if it's art or not. It's just fun to do, right? So, and it also has reference to geocaching, of course. And then there's like the reference to the spy game with dead drops and the hidden stuff in the place. But people then took it further and made all these versions of it. And so this was a show in Lyon where like a graphic design blog put out 5 dead drops, or I don't know, a bunch of them. And you needed to go to these dead drops to see the show, to see the art they produce. Also, people, music bands kind of promoted their albums on it. So you can download a new album on, I don't know what, iTunes. But you can get it for free here when you go there. So there, like, there was tons of press. There was all these variations of the project. It was shown in the MoMA in 2011 at the Talk to Me show, where also people could connect with their laptop and leave stuff in the MoMA. I made this blog post to encourage all artists to bring their digital files and to upload them, and then you can claim you had art in the MoMA, which is kind of like, it's a good thing to have. I made my own versions. I didn't have the pictures, but there's Pirate Box by David Darts. It's a pretty big community. I bet there's people from Pirate Box here. Also in France, it's very big. So it's the same idea, but it's wireless for routers. It's driven on OpenWRT. There's Occupy here. There's all kinds of projects in a similar field. Dead Swap by Dimitri, which was actually prior to this project, was the idea to swap USB drives in person. I think it's a very interesting field. I made these for the Museum of Moving Image. I made the DVD dead drop, which was like, it's like a museum version. It's only one directional, so you get a burned DVD, but from the building. And again, like, it's like this almost deprecated media, yeah, technology, but you can go in there. You get a DVD in the museum shop, and you burn your own DVD. It ran for a whole year, and it has like I put monthly curated content on there, like also from shows to movies to different materials. And again, like the whole building has like this very little suspicious slit, but it kind of becomes a DVD burning drive for a medium which is kind of is over already. What else? I've done a couple, getting to the more interesting stuff now. It's a performance piece I did in New York also while I was there. I had my 3G hotspot with me, so you could connect to internet, actually. I had open internet, but at the same time also, this was kind of, protest for the open internet. So I had funny conversations in the city with people kind of, is this a new business kind of model? And at the same time, for me, kind of, it was already in that time where net neutrality and all these topics kind of really became, very popular. I made protest signs of them, so you kind of carry the open internet or protest for the open internet. This was shown recently in a show in Netherlands. Another piece, which I also showed here 2 years ago at the Congress, how to vacuum form. It's a workshop table, and vacuum forming is a quite classic technique to kind of form plastic material. All the production design people know this. It's kind of the lid of your coffee cup is kind of vacuum formed. So I have this workshop. I made this kind of the mold and everything to vacuum form this, and people at the Congress in 2012 were invited to vacuum form their own Guy Fawkes mask. It was always, often said on the web, like, don't buy these masks, like, you only pour money into the company who's owning the rights. And so why not making them ourselves? And a lot of people, like, there's all these versions with paper and printed, I guess. But this is like a very fast, quick one to make. There's some pictures of the production. It's like a mold, it's like a cast of the mask and then a mold of the cast again. And this was at the Congress 2012. People could make their own masks. And then also, kind of, you cut them, you customize them. And then there's a transparent version, which is interesting, right? Ooh, so yeah. What about, like, I mean, yeah, this whole anonymous story is also kind of, has, I don't know if the peak is, no, well, there's still a lot going on, I know. And still, you can't recognize the person, right? So it's interesting. And then, of course, also, there's the dark side, right? So who's on the dark side? Can be only Tim, right? This was at an opening in beginning of 2012. And I put them in public space to, in yeah, kind of, again, in the context of street art. How to turn code into art. This is, I thought this was something fun to talk about here. I make a lot of these DIY projects, like the mask making, etc. And I think this whole DIY movement is a super interesting format. Also, like how DIY movies or tutorials kind of become more as an entertainment than actual the tutorial itself. So I've done a bunch of them. This is like this is the tutorial how to turn code into art. And sometimes there's very important code, and also I want to encourage you to print code and to frame it. So I'm here explaining how to frame, because you go to the shop, you buy frames, you put it on the wall, and it's art, right? Sort of, this is, sometimes you think this is how it works, and it is, yeah. And in this case, it's a very, was very important code, and it was very well, already well printed by the Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung in Germany, where the CCC, kind of disassembled the German Trojan government spy software and found all these parts in there where, yeah, there was like a backdoor again in the backdoor software, a legal one. So, and I thought like just the and I think this is due to Frank Schirmacher that he really gets the point about many things. They printed this on three spreadsheets in this like super important, yeah, biggest German newspaper. And code is, I don't know, yeah, well, I don't have to tell you, you know, code much better than me, but how important code is today and how kind of, and that's what we learned now all this year, affects us very, very much, right? So I like code as art very much. Greetings from the internet is a postcard series. I collect, whenever you travel somewhere, you want to go on Wi-Fi online and where's the password, and then your friend write it down, and you have this moment of like you have to decode again. Oh, is this a 6 or is it a G? I can't really read it, so you have to guess like the password. So like, this moment before you go online, I take pictures because you always need the code again for like your friend coming or for your other device. But now then I had this collection. I thought I made this postcard series out of it, and of course there's always these errors, right? Password like kitten love. I know, all lowercase, right? It's always it's like this awkward moment. In this summer I printed my open PGP code, my public PGP code, hand printed on canvas, again like making this like a real painting. Like it's a very important picture. I'm not gonna talk about cryptography. There's not been said already yesterday in the keynote how important this is. It's not the salvation to all the problems now, but it's really, I think we're, yeah, obviously we were at this moment now, this year now, where kind of internet, lost its, these moments where the internet was a nice place to play, definitely over, and encryption is gonna be more and more important. And again, also about passwords, Forgot Your Password is a 8-volume printed books. And in these books, you find 4.7 million clear text passwords from LinkedIn, which got stolen in 2012. So when this is on show, you can just like, try to check if your password is in there. I mean, the whole database was much bigger, and there was just a small amount, which was kind of somebody, yeah, the hackers kind of dropped on the in some forums, like decode this or decrypt this, and people kind of decrypt it, and you find a quite big chunk of decrypted passwords. And yeah, I mean, all these services lose their passwords all the time, right? Another, again, like something, a system which is not really working anymore. And it's this very private, right? You're supposed to keep it super private. And there they are. And yeah, it was on the web recently. I'm going to quickly talk about FatLab. It's an artist group founded by James Powderly and Evan Roth in 2007. I'm part of it since 2009. It's very much dedicated to the connection or the sweet spot in between open source and pop culture. It's very much a philosophy which is derived from the graffiti research lab Evan and James were doing before. And it's a lot about copyright, about these privacy questions online. And yeah, with an artistic provocative approach. This is a book which just came out. You can download it for free on the FET website, or you can also have it printed. And in 2010, I'm going to show this one project. We were invited to Google, to Transmediale in Berlin, to the Media Art Festival, and we did a whole week of Fuck Google projects. And there were like all kinds of little interventions online, browser plugins, etc. But we also went in the city with a fake Google car. And so we were building this camera top there and put this mounted all this on the car. There's no tech in there. It's just all mock-up. There's no cameras, nothing recording. But the moment you put a Google sticker on your car, you are Google, right? And nobody would doubt it. Also, it was prior to the Germany very big discussion in 2010 in the summer about privacy. And it's interesting how, yeah, well, let's watch it. Yeah, so all these weird things happen to the Google car, and they kind of, he doesn't know its way, right? The whole, yeah. That was a big topic in 2010. And they have all these weird problems all the time, right? I mean, it's just not working, right? We had a second car, and we were following ourselves through the city, so kind of we claimed on Twitter, we found the Google car, we're following it, and kind of demonstrated against it, but playing this, like, this was all improv, like, but immediately people kind of interacted in the streets. Well, yeah, they got drunk really bad, yeah. And again, a brave citizen. Kind of, he was reaching into his pocket, so it was like everybody's like, "This is a movie." So we had a lot of fun with the car, and I think it's. I think it's very interesting how again, like. It's super easy to understand for the public, oh yeah, there's a car going in the country, they're making pictures of every house, every fence, like my garden, and how like data is collected and browsers with cookies and all this is like so hard to understand and to kind of, yeah, to teach people this. And it's again this moment, I mean, Google wants to be the power plug in the wall you don't think about, right? But you ever tried to call someone there, like, oh yeah, I have a problem with my Gmail? It's like just not possible. It's like these invisible companies, and but the moment there's a car in the city, and was really quite an experience to drive that car because everybody's reacting to it. You could just like stop in the middle of traffic. Nobody will yell at you. It's just because you're Google. So it's kind of, you get the idea of the impact these companies have. Yeah, some other fun projects are coming to an end soon too. The Pirate Bay movie came out beginning of this year. I was lucky to be in the premiere in the cinema, and I also had the idea to make a cam screening version, right? So this was my first cam recorded movie. I had you can download it on there's interviews in the front and up front and also after the movie. This was the best scene in the movie theater, actually. Like, people were like yelling like really loud, and the editor of the movie was sitting right in front of me, and I was like busy with the duct tape like the whole show. And you can download it on as a torrent, of course. It's also on YouTube. But well, yeah, this is like stuff I made for FatLab. The Fuck 3D glasses was 2009. The Avatar was out, and it was really kind of. So all these like little projects, very fast projects, like doing on FatLab is a lot of fun. And then in June, Obama was visiting Berlin, and this was right 2 weeks after the first revelations with Snowden. So I made this mask, and of course, I mean, Obama never wore the Google Glass before, right? But we all know like what's going to happen when all this technology comes in place, and yeah, there's a prism in the front, right? So. And who has access to the data, of course, it's recording all the time to improve the service, right? So I took this in the city and also kind of got it into the media, but also made some nice tweets about it. Obama's visiting the Stasi Museum. This was quite successful online. This was on the show, dropping the internet. Yeah, and that's again, I was missing that word before. It's a very recent piece, and it's a quote. It's like this famous piece by Chinese famous artist Ai Weiwei, and he's dropping the urn, like the super expensive urn from 5,000 years ago, just like dropping it. And it's like this, yeah, that year where for me, like the innocence is kind of, the innocence of the internet is over. Like, we all knew that something was going on, etc. But now it's like, it's on a bigger scale, and yeah, more people get the idea now, but also the, and I discussed this a lot, even like with Liz, who talked yesterday in the morning. She was like, "Oh, this is naive to believe in it." But I mean that belief and like this internet will change, will like make better society, and more democracy, and all these things. And we know, yeah, it's not necessarily only due to that. It depends on us, right? But it still had that, and it's also the subline of the talk: how to make art after Snowden. I mean, there's a lot of these projects which kind of go to the topic, but right now, like after this revelations of the summer, I'm kind of like, I kind of feel numb, like, oh shit, what should I do now? I mean, this is like so big, you do like a fun fat project, but it's like, it's not touching it really. I don't have an answer to that question yet. I mean, of course there needs to be more time, and also I think on the technology level, there's the most interesting stuff now happening. But yeah, of course, there's now a lot of art in that field too, and the angle of prior projects, the perspective people see them, has changed, which is interesting. What I said about dead drops, kind of people really like see it in a different light today. And last but not least, this was my very first show. Let's say I started making art like after school, but beginning of 2000 and. But not really like, oh yeah, maybe I make art, maybe not. And then there was Blinken Lights, which I love very much. You probably all know this interactive facade project for the 20th birthday of the CCC in 2001. And then there was the Blinken area, and which is still downstairs. And actually, I showed my first pieces, my first artwork, in a, let's say in a show, right here on the window. And it's kind of, I was inspired, and all we guys were inspired by Blinken Lights and its brilliance. And I made this analog screen, which was driven by a punch card system. And there's a punch board where you can program the screen I don't give you much time to understand this now, but there's 64 tracks on the paper which control the 64 pixels in the field, and you can program them. And also, there's a super short movie to get an idea. So the light in the back is constant light. There's no electronic circuits going on. It's just a Christmas tea candle chain. And just the holes of the on the punch card kind of, give free way to the light to shine through there. And it's sort of like what the piano and all the other weaving and all these things were, but as a screen, sort of reinvented the screen as it never has been invented, sort of. And also I showed, and that's the last piece I'm showing, Random Screen in 2005 at the Congress, but also I showed it in many shows afterwards. It's pixels, they're blinking, very random, and the pixel itself is very much digital language to us. When you see them, it's like the icon of digital. It's funny today, when you show this kids, they would say it's Minecraft. And then when you look on the backside, you will notice that all these pixels, each pixel is controlled by a tea candle light, and it has a spinning beer can on top, which is like rotating by the rising heat. And so there's only fire on the back, right? And this very much illustrates like what I like to talk about, these two sides, and we're very stuck. Like so I show this in a show, and there's like a tech guy from another piece like asking me how I control all these little motors in there. And like, wait, like, there's no motors in there. Like, we really kind of have the technology thinking also for these kind of events. Okay, so I think this was the talk. What else? I'm doing a workshop upstairs. It's based on this mobile phone blocking pouch, which I also did in 2003. Now it's like there's a lot of products out there already, but you can come upstairs. I will open up afterwards in the foyer D2G, and you can make your own mobile phone blocking pouch from this copper cloth material. And this is my website. You find me on Twitter. Thank you.
Thank you for your great show, and we still have some time to take some questions. There are microphones on the in the aisles, and also there is a signal angel who's been monitoring the IRC and Twitter. Any questions anywhere? Oops. Okay, so no questions.
You have to pose a question. Oh, somebody's waving there. No? Here.
Oh, there's one question on microphone two.
I would like to ask whether it would make sense concerning the dead drops, because they are broken down often enough, and I have seen that in the past. Would it make sense to create wireless dead drops?
So yeah, there are wireless dead drops. I should. It was not in the slideshow, I don't know, for some reason, but there is a pirate box. pirate. Okay, now you know what I'm watching, right? which was made by David Darts. We also made a workshop together two years ago. And there's all these wireless versions of it. Oh, now there's solar graffiti, I don't know. So there, it's out there. Just search for Pirate Box, and there's the library version. There's a whole bunch of people like coding for the OpenWRT field routers. So, and also like all the tech people always said, like, use a cable, right? You will break it, etc. For me, it was very important. Like you plug in your laptop, like really hardware to the building. They're not lasting long, but at the same time, also it's super easy to make, right? You don't like kids make them. You buy them for $5, you put them in the wall, done, right? Also Torrent Freak wrote about it. They were like, oh yeah, this is a cool project. It's not very efficient though for file sharing, right? I mean, you don't know what's on there. You have to go to the place, it might be broken.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
It's symbolic. For me, it's very symbolic, yeah.
Next question, please.
Okay. I'm a little bit irritated because of the subtitle, How to Make Art After Snowden. The most of the art you show was before Snowden.
Yeah.
Was it just a catchy subtitle? Or, I mean, do you really think that, that this... all that, that what happened would change art in the future? Or do you just think that's it's just not so much fun anymore?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. And also, that's what why I talked about these three pictures, that there's no, like, the proper answer to it. Art is always also a mirror of society, and it takes time to kind of see how kind of art reacted to this. There will be, I mean, well, tonight there's a talk by Trevor Paglen. I mean, now there's all these people who've been like doing stuff in that field, and now they're kind of, there's a lot of attention to this coming. Of course, like the subline kind of was like a teaser to come make you come here, right? A hack. But there's no, I mean, it's really, for me, it's like a question, and also when this whole thing happened, it also made me sad, like this belief and all this stuff, and I ask this myself, right?
What do you think is the
The proper answer? Well, we have to find out, right?
No, what do you think is has the hat sich die Aufgabe der Kunst geändert nach diesem Ereignis mit Snowden?
Yeah, this should be die Aufgabe der Kunst. Yeah, so the task of the art. Well, I mean, there's always then we can start to discuss about art and its role in society, and that's a very broad topic, and it goes like from high-end market to like very low-end Tumblr blog. I make people make stuff so much, which is like super important, but don't even consider it art. That's a big question. You have an idea for it?
Well, this Google Street View.
Could you actually, if you want to take a conversation with the artist, might meet him some other place. And I've got a question from the internet.
First of all, I'm asked to say thank you again for the Good Night White Pride shirt you gave to Kitty. And second, Frost asked, how do you make a living? And he said, perhaps he missed that, but...
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a mix of like giving talks, getting paid for giving talks, not here, but... So it's like workshops, giving talks, showing art, like getting artist fees for showing art, but also selling art. It's like a whole, I do the whole wide range of that. So. It's not easy to make a living as an artist. If you want to make money, don't make art, right? But at some point, I don't make anything on the side. But it's like what I showed since 2003. I mean, I did a lot of stuff on the side. This was just like this was my side project. Now I only make art, but it's never easy.
Okay. So there are no more questions. Once again, thank you very much, and I overlooked the microphone, I'm so sorry. Yeah. So, one question on microphone one.
Hi. I think we've got 3 minutes. I was wondering about the Google Car project. What did you do with that? Was that just for the performance of doing it in the time? I know you showed some video here, but was there, was it documented? What was the point of it, just a performance of doing it, or is there more on it? Is there a longer video piece or something?
Yeah, well, that's like it has different layers. Of course, there's always when you do performance in public space, then the video, when there's video of it, is the only documentation, and there's an art always the discussion is the documentation the piece or not. Most people have seen this as a video, and fewer people have seen it in public space. So you can argue about this, and this is true for many like performance art from over all the decades. In this case, I mean, FatLab works very much online, so there was a, it started as a hoax, actually. So there was all the big press, Huffington Post, etc. They were like, oh yeah, there's this FatLab, and they're following the Google car in Germany. It really started as a hoax online, and kind of a few days later was then uncovered. And of course, it's also when you work with Google and you do car, I mean, the idea was to make stuff with Google car which they wouldn't do and don't want to see it in that kind of light, right? So at the same time, that was like while driving that car, it's like kind of scary. Everybody was like, oh yeah, the Google car, kind of being enthusiastic about it. So as an artist, like, it's important when you make these things that you kind of, yeah, you're on a thin line too. It's very important how you make this, I think.
Okay. Thanks.
One last question. Okay.
My question is also about the Google car and about being critical. I'm a little bit surprised that you said that Snowden was such a big shock, because I knew you as being critical against capitalism and surveillance. And can you just describe a little bit what really was the shock?
Yeah. That's a discussion I also already mentioned I had with Liz. I mean, it's like, and it was mentioned over the past months also, like often, like one said, oh, we all knew this, nothing new, why you're so, like, why are you freaking out? And on the other hand, for a lot of people, it's new. It's not like, it's really, I mean, it's so important that this happened, and it's really good, of course. And, but it kind of makes, or as my works and all these things, and what I also showed in the beginning, that's what I said about the names above our head. I kind of was thinking about digital and online and offline, etc. And now it's so close. It's already here. It's kind of like, and all the info is out there. They have like all the data to just make this, and it becomes so scary. Like that's like I think for myself, sort of like the experience. What kind of makes me so much think about it? It's not so shocking, super shocking news, right? Yeah.
Okay, thank you, and thank you for attending. If you like this talk, you can rate it on the conference wiki, or actually the Pentabarf. And as you leave the room, please take everything with you brought in with you. That includes everything that might have transformed into trash and empty bottles. Thank you.